Accession number 13928, reel 1.
Mr. Davis, reel 1. Whereabouts were you born, please?
Born in Southampton.
Which year was that?
Which year? 1908.
And what?
Winchester Road, Southampton.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a schoolmaster. He's a handicraft master.
Did you go to school in Southampton?
Yes, at the elementary schools, and then the Taunton's Grammar School. I got a scholarship for that.
How old were you when you completed your schooling?
I went on till I was 17.
To 1925?
Yes, and then I joined Supermarine.
Why did you decide to join Supermarine?
Well, my father knew the manager, works manager. I never belonged to a club, and they got talking together. And he said to me, how would you like to join Supermarine? Now, this was good because I had always been interested in aeroplanes at school. Now, any books on aeroplanes I dug out, going back to 1912, you know. So, really, it suited me. So I said, yes.
What kind of a reputation did Supermarines have in the city as an employer?
As an employer, very good, very good. And it had a good reputation from the point of view of its the quality of its work, you know, long before you heard of R.J. Mitchell and that. It always had a good reputation. From when I was 1925, you know, I was quite young.
What advice did your employers give you on starting?
On starting?
Did they give you some advice about what they expected of you?
Not really. I do remember one incident when I was in the metal shop, I think it was. That's right, the charge hand came to me and said, now look, sonny, this is important work. Near enough will not do. And then a ground engineer I was helping doing an engine, you know, reconditioning an engine, said, look, sonny, don't forget, a man's life is in your hands. Make sure how you do it. Those two things still stick with me.
What kind of work were you put onto at first?
Oh, in the metal shop, making things, you know, I was an apprentice. I was working with a man, and whatever he was making, I helped, you know. I remember doing the radiator of an aeroplane, radiator mounting, rather. Can't remember much else, tell the truth. That was in the metal shop. Then I moved on to the machine shop, worked on all sorts of things, you know, working lathes and that sort of thing. And then another year I was working on the erecting shop, putting things together. And from the erecting shop, I applied to have a job in the drawing office. And that's when I started in the drawing office.
What kind of work were Supermarines engaged on in the second half of the 1920s when you were there?
Well, they brought out the Swan. It was a twin-engine passenger boat. The Southampton, which became famous. A single-engine Seagull, I think they called it, for Spain and that sort of thing. We had a good foreign contacts, and this is, I'm thinking 1920s in particular. What else? Dear idea. Turkish, yes, the Turkish Southamptons, some for Denmark. It's so many. You have a job to sort them out, but they're all flying boats in those days. No aeroplanes.
Did you see any spectacular flights when you first joined?
Well, the day I joined, They were weighing the propeller of the S4 racer, which is a famous racer. And I saw that flying, and we heard that they'd made a world speed record flying around the Isle of Wight with Henri Billard.
Can you tell me who Henri Billard was?
Well, he was our test pilot, and he was a pilot in the First World War.
Was he French?
No, Channel Islands.
Did you ever meet him personally?
I don't think I did, no.
You said that you joined the drawing office. I think that you've written in your notes this was 1929.
Yes.
Were there any problems with the work that you had to do there?
Well, no, I was put in what was called the modifications department, which rather displeased me. Because I wanted to get on and do design work, you know. And as you saw in my notes, I left the firm because I wasn't satisfied. But this was quite the practice in those days. Every firm kept its secrets to itself. And other people of my age, would leave and join another firm to get experience. And I went, as I said, to Westland aeroplane people. And they were so different from our own firm that I've never regretted going there because of the experience I received at Westland's.
Did you ask at Supermarines to be put on to design work?
Oh, yes. Yes.
What response did you get?
Well, I think it was, you better wait. I know when I gave in my notice to leave, the chief draftsman was very upset. And he said, well, look, supposing I put you over with Arthur Shervell, who was Mitchell's right-hand man, why not stay? And I said, look, I've agreed to take this job, and I feel I ought to honour it. So he said, well, all right, that's that.
Where was Westlands?
At Yeovil. Still there, the firm is still there. They make helicopters now. But the Westland Aircraft Firm was one of the 20-odd firms working, you know, at that time.
How did Westlands differ from your point of view from Supermarines?
Well, the office was about the same. And Chief Draftsman was about the same. But to me, it was working for Captain G.T.R. Hill, who was on Pterodactyl. Now, the Pterodactyl was a tailless aeroplane with the engine at the rear. And it was supposed to be non-stallable. There were aeroplanes used to stall in those days, you know. And I had some most interesting experience doing the drawings, wing drawings mostly, for Captain Hill. And he also gave me very specific ideas of how to design for the lowest weight, which would serve me very well in my stead later on. Because weight, of course, was our problem, as you guess. Weight and strength, anyway.
Can you remember the specific advice he gave you?
Yes, He produced a drawing of a rib with braces. And he said, we will work out what they should be for strength. And then we will make these less. And then we will test it and see where it fails. And sure enough, one failed, you see, at some figure. So we really got the lightest possible rib.
Which was the more enjoyable for you, working at Supermarines or at Westlands?
Oh, Westlands, every time. They took more interest in me, Captain Hill particularly, you know. And it was interesting work. And not to say it wouldn't have been interesting if I'd stayed at Supermarine if they put me on design work, you know, but I was basically a designer. A designer is distinct from an ordinary draftsman, you know. There aren't many real designers, you know, even in a huge office. I don't think there are more than about five in our office who were designers, really able to design. Other people would do what they were told. And so I was always interested in design, right from my schoolboy days when I read these books, somehow or other. I had a very interesting career.
Did you stay long at Westland?
No, only about a year. And then I moved on to Boulton and Paul's at Norwich. That was most interesting. Different people, different chief designer, J.D. North. He was a brilliant man. He had a brilliant brain. He'd study a subject, new subject, and even lecture on it in a few weeks. And as an aircraft designer, he was brilliant. But he was very dogmatic. He wanted his own way. And Air Ministry was our main customer. And we lost some contracts. But in the end, he produced such good stuff, and particularly the side strand bomber, that they had to take it up.
Do you remember the Air Ministry people visiting the works?
No, I don't think I did. They probably only kept in his office, you know. But I knew of them. We knew of them. And we knew. The thing is, in those days, the Air Ministry, it was an experimental process. They didn't know what we designers could do. They didn't know what they wanted, except they wanted the best. It was a question of probing and sorting things out. And between us, we produced the answer. This applied even in the Spitfire days. It was quite a process. Now, I did meet some of the Air Ministry people on the Spitfire, and they were very, very sound people. And if you'd explain what you were doing, you'd say, oh, I see, yes. This is a very good design for an undercarriage, they said, of the Spitfire, for instance, which it was. But you can see the problem. They wanted the best, but they didn't know what we could do.
Why do you say, in what way was the side strand bomber so good?
Efficient. It was a very large span, but it was good in the weight it carried, as a proportion of its own weight. And, of course, it was performed all right.
Were you personally working on the side strand?
No, I worked on what's called the B-12, B-1236, I put in my notes, which was a new bomber. And the ministry eventually, it was in 1931 or 2, we were short of money. The country was short of money. You remember a lot of all sorts of things done. Managing MacDonald cut down this, that, and the other. And they stopped the design. They said, look, we can't afford to buy it. So there was this very good aeroplane, the B-1236, and it came to nothing except the drawings.
Had you had any problems with the wings of that bomber?
No, I just I worked under supervision for a section leader, and just did what we wanted, you know. No problems. It was very advanced. It was made of steel, you know, very advanced construction.
Was it a two-engine bomber?
Two. You know, I've forgotten. I don't think it was. I think it was a one-engine. But I'm not quite certain now. It goes back a long way.
Any incidents that happened to you at Norwich that you remember?
No.
Were they testing planes there, actually at Norwich?
Oh, yes, at the aerodrome. They flew them. They flew them from Norwich, yes. But people in the drawing office don't see that. The people that see them flying are the performance people who they know what they want, and they go and see the things flying.
How strict were these three firms, Supermarines and Westlands and Bolton and Paul? Were they strict to their workers?
Well, I suppose they were. We just did what we were told. They were very strict on secrets. If you gave anything away to outsiders, in fact, there was the, what was it called? Some restriction act that you'd have been put in prison if you gave away certain things. I know somebody who did go to prison because he gave away some secrets, took some drawings home and this sort of thing. Because they were all jealous of each other, all the firms were.
Which factory did that happen in, where the person betrayed the secret?
This was Short's, Short Brothers, in Rochester. And he went to prison for about a year, I think. Eventually he joined us, came to Supermarine.
But that was to another British firm, was it?
Hmm?
He betrayed the secret to another British firm, or to foreigners.
I don't know quite what he did do. I don't think it was the foreigners. I think it was more for taking drawings home. You know, they said, this is dangerous.
Now, I think you left Bolton and Paul in 1933.
Yes.
Why did you do that?
Oh, I was sacked. They ran out of money. I think they sacked most of us. And they did write and asked us to come back. But in the meantime, I approached Supermarine and said, did they want me? And they said yes. They'd have me back, and that was that. And I stayed with Supermarine all my working life.
So you weren't unemployed for long?
Not for long, no. Well, a few weeks, I suppose, but not for too long.
What work did they put you on to back at Supermarine?
The first job I did at Supermarines was on the Turkish Southampton kitchen equipment, of all things. Quite simple stuff. And I remember particularly then, section leader, he said to me, you know, your stuff looks very flimsy compared with the rest of the aeroplane. I'd been applying Captain G.T.R. Hill's dictum of saving weight, you see. And I said, yes, but what I've got is strong enough, isn't it? And he said, well, yes, I suppose it is. But it does show that what I'd learnt from Captain Hill and on weight saving was already bearing fruit. And it did for all my working life, this weight saving.
Why was it called the Turkish Southampton?
Well, there was some they were building for Turkey. Special order. You know, it was a standard machine, more or less. I think we had different engines, but it was more or less a standard aeroplane. But they wanted this kitchen equipment, unusually. You know, preparing food and all this sort of thing inside. So there was me, very innocent, put on it.
And then I think that you worked on the Scapa flying boat?
Yes, well, on the Scapa, that had been designed while I was away, prototype. And my job on the Scapa was to turn the prototype drawings, some of them anyway, into production drawings, and other people were doing the same. So we productionized the machine. Mainly, when you productionize, you make them simpler. I mean, the prototype, you just knock them up any old how. When it comes to production, you've got to think of the process as a manufacture, and therefore you change the design in detail. And I worked on the Scapa production.
You seem to have specialised a lot on wings.
Well, it seemed that I did. In the early days, I'd do anything. They give you a petrol system to do. Anything that had to be done, you were called up and said, do it. But I did gradually gravitate onto wings and wing structures. I did have a chance of going on a fuselage or hull, but Somehow or other, the wings appealed to me, and I did specialise, and it proved very, very useful indeed.
And the Stranraer flying boat?
Stranraer, I had to do the basic design of the fin and rudder and tail plane. and I was left on my own to do that. I was beginning to design work from scratch.
What did people think of these two particular flying boats, the Scapa and the Stranraer?
Well, the Scapa was a great advance on the old Southampton, both for speed and general performance. The Stranraer was even larger, and it was the last of the supermarine flying boats. But at the time, its top speed was higher than any other flying boat in the world.
Was the firm expanding at that time?
Yes, more or less all the time. Yes.
When did you first come into contact with the Spitfire?
Well, I don't know exactly when, but I was certainly put on the Spitfire. I had to do some odd wing ribs, again on the wing ribs, and I was working in conjunction with an older man. And that was a start. But later on, I was put on to the gun installation. The eight gun became the rule. We had to have an eight gun Spitfire. And it was explained to me by someone that the idea was you've got to get as many bullets as you can in a short burst, and that six guns wouldn't do. We had to have eight. And I had the job of designing the mountings, the gun mountings and the ribs each side, and the boxes, the ammunition boxes and the feed chutes. In other words, the whole gun installation I did.
What were the main problems with that work?
I don't think I ran into any problems. I just did it, and it seemed to work. I ran into some problems later on with the Spano Suiza gun. The Spano Suiza was a cannon, got a big circular magazine. It held about 50 bullets, you know. And they smuggled this over from France just after the war, after the French broke down. And so we had the first one in our works. And we did have trouble. I was put on the design of the mounting for this gun. And it made such a blister on the wing, spoilt the shape of the wing, that I decided to turn it on its side because it was lower. And that was all right, except the trouble we had with the ejection chutes for the cartridge, the spent cartridges. They came falling out and jamming at the exit. Terrible job that was. And it took several modifications to clear it.
But going back to when you first worked on the Spitfire, I think you had to produce drawings for gun heating.
Oh, yes. That was, I don't think it was when I first went on the Spitfire, but at some stage after, they had to heat the guns because they would freeze. And I was given the job of ducting hot air from the radiator to the guns. And this was much more difficult than it appeared. Partly because the radiator is only on one wing and not the other wing, so when you came to the other wing, you had to conduct it right across the fuselage. But I found that it wouldn't work, and so in the end, I had to baffle off each rib, each side of the gun, you know, with lightweight stuff, and pump the heat in. We had a lot of trouble with the gun heating. But eventually, of course, we overcame it. That was a job to do.
Did you work on the photo reconnaissance?
Yes. Spitfire? Yes, I was given that job 100%. I'd working 1 weekend. They told me what they wanted. We spoke to somebody from the Air Ministry. And I had to mount the cameras, some going down through a hole in the floor, and others going out at the side. When you say mount the cameras, that sounds quite easy, but of course there were other things in the fuselage in the way, like flying control wires. In other words, a lot of modifications to make room for the cameras. But they went in. And then I was asked to provide a tank. Now, what we did in the wings, we took out two of the guns. Well, they weren't there anyway, where the guns would have been. And I redesigned a big compartment for which we filled with petrol. And we also filled we also put petrol in the nose, what they call the nose cone of the wing, you know, the nose, to get range.
When you first started working on the Spitfire, did you realise it was a special sort of plane?
Well, no. Well, we realised it was special, but as far as I was concerned, it was a job of work. And when we'd finished, I went on to the bomber. Never saw the Spitfire fly. It wasn't until later on it became famous. But we were told that it had to be right. Now, the section leader, a chap called Faddy, was never satisfied with what you did. I'd do a scheme for something, and he'd say, well, don't you think you ought to try this, that, and the other, you see? So I said, right. So I'd tear that up and improve on that scheme. And very often, a third scheme to get the lightest weight and the simplest design. Because with design, you've got to get simplicity. And so things were done two and three times on paper. But he said it's cheaper to, design with the pencil, no, draw with the pencil and design with the rubber. He said that's cheaper than building a machine, that's no good and you have to water everything. But we were very, very finicky with the Spitfire, more so than most aeroplanes.
Why do you think that was?
Well, I think we knew it had to be better than anything the Germans did, so we had to make sure that it was the best fighter. And of course, Faddy, who was Faddy by nature, as it were, he was the right man to make sure we got it right.
Were you conscious all the time of competing with the German Air Force?
Oh, yes. And we were also working under pressure. One of the local doctors said he had more people ill from Supermarine than anyone else in the village, because we were in a village outside Southampton. And I suffered from stomach troubles, you know, and worry. No doubt we were very, very strained. Very strained all along.
Was that because you thought a war was coming?
No, I think it was just pressure by the chief draftsman, you know, to get working. He didn't let up at all. You know, he'd say, you've got to work until you drop, sort of thing. We were very, very hard driven.
Can you tell me about the work that you did on the wing of the Mark IV Spitfire?
Yes, that was the turned out to be my last job. The Mark IV started off in a humble way, but they realised they had to have a stronger wing. And we made the normally with a Spitfire, the nose box took all the torsion and the bending. But the trailing portion was just light. Well, with the Mark IV, we had to make strength in the trailing portion. It meant redesigning everything. Even any door that opened had to have special catches to take stress. And this went on and on. And in fact, eventually, by the time we got the thing to the manufacturing stage, it was called the Mark 20. You know, they forgot Mark IV. But I was in charge of the wing then, in charge of the wing design. And I did, of course, a lot myself. I remember having to redesign the duct, radiator duct, because we had a bigger engine. When I think back, I go hot and cold. I looked at the old design. I knew certain rules about expansion of air, you know, because you to avoid any